Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For many internet users, the comments on news articles, blog posts, Twitter, Facebook, and more are best left unread unless you want your blood pressure to suddenly spike. But my guest this hour thinks we should read the comments, even when they sometimes turn toxic or misleading. He explores the many ways online commentary can influence us for better or worse in the book Reading the Comments, Likers, Haters, and Manipulators at the Bottom of the Web. My guest is the author of this book, Joseph M. Riegel, Jr., an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Northeastern University, and he joins me this morning. Good morning, Professor. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, John.
So you use the term the bottom of the web in the title of your book. Where did that come from?
I do. It comes from this wonderful Twitter account by game designer Shane Lesgan, and he has this Twitter account called Avoid Comments. And over the course of a year or so, he tweeted out 100 comments just saying how terrible comments online are and why you're best off avoiding them. And one of those was, there's a reason comments are at the bottom of the internet. And so I took that and kind of ripped on that, because that was really the thing I was talking about. It's the stuff in the margins and in the bottom. And they seem innocuous, or at the worst, they seem horrible and best avoided. But as you said, I wanted to sort of make a journey, an expedition to the bottom of the web and see what I could figure out.
Did you wear any kind of special clothing for that journey so you didn't get contaminated by all the radioactive commentary?
No, but I did have a handy supply of what they call unicorn chasers. Have you heard that term, John?
No, that's a new one for me.
So when you see something awful online, you're like, oh, I need a unicorn chaser. So you go look at pictures of kittens and puppies and things like that. They're like,
I'll have to keep that in mind the next time I'm looking at Facebook. This has become a rather serious problem. I mean, it seemed like a really great idea at first. Hey, we're all going to be able to chat with each other. But I mean, you know, since the internet's been around, even going back to the old dial-up bulletin board systems, you always had there's always been this element of people who, particularly if they can remain anonymous, will say the first thing that comes into their mind, and usually it's pretty negative. Some newspapers now have shut down their comment sections.
Mm-hmm.
Because the discourse had just devolved into something pretty awful.
Yeah, very much true. And if you look at it historically, it's quite fascinating, and there's a lot of stuff going on, but you can go back to Plato in his book, The Republic, and he tells a story about King Gyges. And apparently in Plato's telling of the story, he was a shepherd who found a ring of invisibility, used the ring, became powerful, was able to kill the king, bed his queen, and take over the kingdom. And really throughout history, we've seen this idea of what happens to people when they become anonymous or when they lose accountability. And there's no really simple answers. But, you know, we do, some people at least do seem to behave a little bit differently online.
So what's so interesting to you about how we use comments on the internet?
Well, the book was really motivated by a series of, to use a comment, and I won't expand it because it's not for polite company, but WTF moments. Sometimes you'll see lots of things in comments, like people will say first. I don't know if you've ever seen those. And it's people just trying to get in and post the first comment, or they'll post WTF. And I just kept having these experiences where I was thinking, what is going on here? I begin the book with an experience of watching a YouTube video, and this has become a somewhat popular genre. You can find dozens of these, where it was a young woman posting a video of herself saying, people tell me I'm ugly all the time. Do you think I'm ugly? And I thought, oh my gosh, go into YouTube to ask, I mean, some of the commenters there are the worst, to ask YouTube commenters, am I ugly or not? What is going on? And so really the book was just motivated by all these moments of me thinking, what the heck?
And I have to confess, I rarely read the comments in YouTube videos, so that was a real revelation to me. Because of the work I do, most of the comments I see are the comments that appear at the bottoms of news stories and columns and things like that, and the things that show up on Facebook. But perhaps we should stop for a moment and define the term comments. So when you use the term comet, what counts as a comet? How do you define it?
Right. So it is a bit of a fuzzy definition, but I say that they're short. It could be as short as like a plus one or a thumbs up button. It could be a couple of words. It could be a couple of sentences, not more than a paragraph or two. I say they're reactive in that, you know, you're reacting to something. So it's in response to a book review. It's in response to a news article. But it's not always responsive. There's this aphorism you often see online called TLDR, too long, didn't read. So while people are sometimes are sort of having even knee-jerk reactions, it doesn't mean they've really subsequently engaged with whatever it is that they're reacting to. And then it's asynchronous. So it means the response can come within a second or a couple minutes or even a couple of days, but it's not like the real-time interaction we're having, the give and take right we're doing now. And then I say, I know that's rough. You might sort of quibble at the edges, but really the thing, the essence of what I am looking at is the stuff at the bottom of the web and on the margins.
Yeah, you mentioned the too long, didn't read. You can almost guarantee that almost any news story will get a series of comments from people who didn't actually read it but are simply reacting to the headline, or they're reacting to the source of the story. They don't agree with that particular online news organization's approach to the world and so forth. And so these comments are just kind of automatic, and you can just see it. I mean, it's like mushrooms popping up after a hard rain. They're going to be there. As soon as the story shows up, somebody's going to post. And I've always wondered, well, if you're not going to read the story, why post the comment? What motivates people to do this kind of thing?
Well, there's not a lot of studies of exactly understanding the motives of why people post comments, but this phenomena of posting very quickly, I think it again relates to this comment first. Sometimes someone will post a comment to an article that just says first, and that's all it is, and it's quite common. And I think the way often that websites are structured and their comment systems are structured, there's a incentive to post quickly because you get to be right under the message. And people like seeing their name. They like seeing they have some sort of effect. People have done studies and actually shown that sometimes the sentiments expressed in a story very quickly in the ones that people see are likely to then bias and influence the rest of the comments that follow. Similarly, if you can post something, if it's like a commercial product or a particular political ideology, I think people are doing some sort of advocacy there, they think, at least in their mind.
Mm-hmm. Some systems moderate comments, so the top comment isn't necessarily the first. How does that change the discourse?
Yeah, so there are different ways of doing it. So I think instead of having a first through the last, having the most relevant or the highest rated comment can be advantageous. I noted this phenomenon a couple of years ago called the rush and slash effect. That's what I called it. And I used to hang out and read comments on this geeky website, news site called Slashdot. And they have moderators there. And so what they can do is they can rate a plus one or a plus minus of a comment, whether they think it's useful or not. But one of the things I realized is even though that's pretty good at getting out of the worst comments, it wasn't good at highlighting the best comments. And the reason is, I think, was that the people who are really active on the site and who have these points that they can then allocate and say, oh, this was a good comment, this wasn't a good comment. They tended to read the site very currently, contemporaneously. So they were going to be reading the articles within an hour of them being posted. And the consequent was that, again, if you posted, I ended up doing the figures, if most people saw most comments within like a couple hour window, and if where I set my threshold of saying what quality of comments I wanted to read, I would never see any comments older than, say, 12 hours. And so there are ways that we can improve the system, our comment systems, but there's still basic sort of social dynamic issues at the heart of what's going on.
You know, there are a lot of people who say they never read the comments because they perceive most comments to be too negative or ill-informed. I mean, why should we bathe ourselves in all that negativity?
Yeah. Well, so this is an interesting thing on the book cover. It says, I advocate we read the comments. In the book, I'm a little more nuanced, and I say, not all of us should read all of the comments all of the time. In fact, I say I read the comments so you don't have to. And so I read the comments because I had my unicorn chasers and I had the fortitude and I was looking at this as research, so I wasn't getting that upset myself about some of these things I was looking at. But for a researcher such as myself, then who would like delve into all the muck and then report back his findings, I think it was very useful and instructive for me. But I don't necessarily advocate that everyone, ordinary people, do all the time if they find it too troubling.
Okay. Well, we'll pick that up on the other side of the news. We're going to take a quick break. We want to know what you think, though. 800-642-1234. Share your comments about comments. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. Find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook and Twitter. Try not to derail the discussion. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joseph Riegel is my guest this hour. His new book, Reading the Comments, Likers, Haters, and Manipulators at the Bottom of the Web. We're talking about online commentary. The online part is new, but the commentary part isn't. This has been going on since at least Plato, and it continues. Galileo got involved in some things related to what we now call online commentary. And we're discussing that this hour with Joseph Riegel and with you at 800-642-1234. You can also make a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet at the Joy Cardine Show. Send an email to talk@WPR.org. All ways to get in touch. We have some calls, and we should probably get to them. Let's start in Stoughton, where John joins us. John, good morning. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me. As I was telling your screener, I'm an active commenter. I have an account with Discuss, and it is tied into a variety of news websites, also some entertainment websites and some other stuff. But I find that, first of all, I'm laughable. The someone who gets so upset over the comments that they would have to go and detoxify themselves. I enjoy the comments. It's more entertaining than the story itself. I kind of self-identify as a libertarian, so I have equal disregard and disdain for both Democrats and Republicans. So when I end on news stories, it's funny because the responses to my comments either paint me as a raving right-winger or as a communist propagandist, depending on the story and who I've offended. I don't purposely intend to offend, but people are so married to their ideology that if you write an opposing view to the story or to someone else's comment, it really gets people worked up. I find it entertaining. I don't find it at all offensive, even when people personally attack me. And it's all done anonymously, of course. But, you know, I think anonymous commenting is something that's almost an American tradition. If you go back to Benjamin Franklin wrote anonymously, in his paper. And I don't see anything wrong with it. And the idea that that news websites, moderate their comment sections, I find ridiculous.
John, thanks for that insight. Joseph Riegel?
Yeah, sure. So it's very interesting that John says that he's a libertarian and really enjoys the political battles. For some people, that's certainly the case. The question is when things get really sort of heated and people get actually violent in their comments, or whether you actually want to have a civil substantive sort of discussion. And so what almost seems a little bit paradoxical, John said, was that he seems to enjoy it. He doesn't find it offensive, but he's also surprised at the extent to which people paint him into a corner that he doesn't think he actually belongs in. So I was wondering, could I ask John, have you had a substantive conversation with someone online in the comment section?
John, are you still with us?
He actually belongs in.
Hello, John. I think we lost him.
Okay. Because that's what I would be most interested by. One of the questions I really like to ask my students is, when was the last time you changed your mind? And that's also something I really often like to ask myself. And so, sure, for a lot of newspaper sites, people do go, I enjoy reading the comments. I actually enjoy reading civil substantive disagreements. But very often, particularly when you stray into particular issues, people get extremely violent and threatening and harassing. And so I think we can distinguish between civil or even rancorous sort of civil debate and the comments where we end up seeing really harassing, horrible speech. In the UK recently, they were discussing whether they should change, whether I think it's Darwin on the £5 note, and have a woman on the bill. And some of the women behind actually saying, let's have more women on the bills, they received hundreds and hundreds of horrifying Twitter harassments and threats and death threats and rape threats and all that sort of stuff. So I think when we're saying, you know, the really horrible stuff, that's the sort of comment that we're talking about.
Well, and look what happened when President Obama opened his own personal Twitter account. I mean, it was just a matter of moments before the racial epithets started to fly.
Right. Yeah. And so some of us might have more tolerance for that than others. If you've been online for a while, you just might think, oh, goodness, here we go. In fact, there's an aphorism called Godwin's Law, and it was coined back in the, 20, 30 years ago, before the web existed, but the internet was still being used. And it says, as the duration of a conversation online increases, inevitably someone's going to end up calling someone else a Nazi or a Hitler. And so they just spoke to the fact that no matter what happens, something horrible is going to come out of the discussion thread. And maybe what's now different as it was sort of 20 years ago is that it only takes seconds now for that sort of thing to happen.
Well, and going back to something that John said about people being married to their ideologies, I mean, there are a lot of just total knee-jerk reactions if someone posts, oh, you're just a liberal, or oh, you're just a conservative, as if being one of those things made one worthy of dismissal instead of, there's just an awful lot of ad hominem argument. You don't get a lot of good reasoning. I guess if somebody wanted to use the comment section of most online news outlets as a way to teach rhetoric, there would be examples of almost every rhetorical fallacy ever conceived within the first 30 comments.
Indeed, I think you're right there. And again, I think going back to sort of John's libertarian point, I was a libertarian once in my own philosophy, and there's this idea of this sort of free speech rhetoric that you can just let the comment section have anonymous contributions and let people work it out, and what will be will be. But I think, and that has a long tradition in history and online culture, actually. But I think one of the things that we're beginning to realize is, while that might have worked 20 years ago and people still might have gotten in flame wars, we also have sort of a new breed of what I call haters, which are kind of like the trolls of ages old. But in this new sort of environment, I don't believe that you can have unfettered, unregulated, unmoderated comment spaces as easily as we did in the past and still have civil substantive discussion without the racism and the sexism and the misogyny and all that sort of rearing its head so quickly.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join our discussion. We're talking about online comments. One other aspect of this that we haven't really touched on yet is reviews. You write that product reviews are one way that comments can inform us, but they also manipulate us when companies pay people to write fake reviews. How prevalent is this?
Very. Again, it's one of these things. I love reading product reviews. In the book, I talk about how I was buying a $6 product in a store, and I was like, oh, is this a lemon? And I have an app on my phone that allows me to scan the barcode, and I can immediately see what the Amazon reviews for the product are. And in one regard, I think this is ridiculous. It's a $6 stupid little product I'm buying, but that's my sort of personality. They call it Maxificers. We like to get the best always. But we also have to appreciate that based on research, it seems that probably 10 to 30% of the reviews that you see out there on sites like Amazon and Yelp are fake or manipulated in some way. So it's quite common.
Well, Tyler writes on Facebook, I do read the comments, although I am not so sure that all of them aren't paid for. I do think there are agencies out there that pay people to post propaganda or inciting comments and then defend them. That would apply both to news stories and to reviews. There are people who hire people to either write good reviews for their product or write bad reviews for somebody else.
Certainly. Samsung got in a lot of trouble a couple of years ago with this. I think this was actually part of their corporate strategy and their advertising, because there were so many cases of them paying people to write reviews and skew their reviews. And it's also not that hard to find. All you have to do is go to Craigslist and type in write reviews, and you'll find dozens of people saying either I'm willing to write reviews, I already have an Amazon account or a Yelp account, or people saying, can you write reviews for us? So it's very, very common, actually.
So, I have to say that a lot of times the Amazon reviews can be hilarious. There are some just absolutely, there's some great satire being written in the form of reviews. Who knew? Maybe it's a new art form.
Yeah, I talk about it in the book. One of my favorites is the banana slicer. And you wouldn't think you need a banana slicer. But what I loved about it, and I thought it exemplified comments so well, is that the one was, it's a curved banana. So the banana slicer was kind of curved to the left. The points were pointing to the left, and said, I bought this banana slicer, but it only works for left curving bananas. So I only give it 4 stars. And then someone else said, you idiot. You have to buy the matching right curving banana slicer. And they basically emulated this flame war about this ridiculous product on Amazon. So, yeah, this is one of the things that make me chuckle when I'm online. I actually like this. I find it kind of engaging and funny. And it's a whole genre now. George Takei, Mr. Sulu on Star Trek, The Old Generation, many years ago, he's pretty famous now online. He's got a huge social media following. And he's one of the top Amazon reviewers because he actually likes to write these farcical reviews.
And he's very good at it. But reviews, I mean, now we're not just talking about political discourse and people just throwing bombs back and forth, which is, you get a lot of what I call bomb throwers. When we're talking about reviews, if you own a restaurant, you get a couple of bad Yelp reviews, and all of a sudden, no one's showing up at your door. I mean, people actually rely on these things to decide where they're going out to eat, for example, or what kind of product they're going to buy, or what hotel to stay in. So now there are financial consequences to some of this stuff. That's not good, is it?
No, I feel sorry for merchants. Well, I feel sorry for everyone, actually, in the current circumstance we're in. Because in the book, I argue that in this world, we're all really tempted to become shills. Because if I was a merchant, I would definitely feel like I need to make sure I have good reviews on Yelp. And so I can encourage my customers to write a good review. But where is that line? If I give them a coupon for writing a review, or if I give them a coupon for writing a positive review, or if I have a friend or a family member who might write a positive review, it seems to me like a very slippery slope. And, then you have actual customers talking about Yelp when the server walks by, hoping that they'll get better service. There's actually this ridiculous product. You buy, spend $100 and get this review card that showed you were a professional reviewer. And it didn't come from anyone like Michelin or anything like that. But you would just wave this card around, kind of threatening the servers and the restaurant owners, hoping that you'll get better service, because basically you're telling them, if you're not nice to me, I'm going to write a nasty review on Yelp. So on one hand, I love the reviews. I'm a review addict myself. I take it all with a grain of salt. But I also realize that it's making it such that it's very hard to trust anything or anyone that you see online.
But the reviews, I mean, they're supposed to be useful. Do we need them? I mean, we got by without them before the Internet. Word seemed to get around if a place had bad service or something. But reviews can be very useful, can't they?
Oh, certainly. That's why I say I love the reviews. And part of it is, like, we now have so much online commerce. I am a little bit chagrined to say some of the things I buy online. I buy my toilet paper online now. And There's a lot of reasons why we do this. It's convenient. It's cheap. Now that I have the toilet paper I like, I'd always go into the pharmacy and there'd be like a new sale. And I'm like, how many square feet? And is it the proper ply? And is it the toilet paper I like? It was just confusing. Now I know what I like. It's in my wish list. It's very easy to order. But because we have so many of these disintermediated interactions online now, it's natural to sort of want to know what other people are saying and thinking about the products and services we're going to use. So reviews make a lot of sense. They're very handy. I am reading them all of the time, which is why they're so prone to being targeted by scammers and manipulators, because as you said, they're worth a lot of money.
Well, it may also spur hotels and restaurants to actually give better service in the first place, to make sure everybody who leaves their establishment leaves happy and with a smile on their face, hoping they'll get a good review or at least avoid a bad one. I mean, isn't this a spur to giving us better service as consumers?
I would hope so, and I think you can find instances of that, of where that is working well. For instance, I recently bought a mattress online. Again, it's one of these things I never thought I would buy online, but there's now a couple of marketers call it an experience good. Experience goods are like shoes or mattresses. You want to touch them, you want to feel them before you make your opinion. But then again, going into a mattress store, I feel like it's a used car lot. And even if you see a mattress in the actual showroom, it doesn't mean that's what it's going to feel like when you get it home. Consumer Reports has actually studied that. And so, again, I turned to the online space and I found a couple of companies that make these relatively inexpensive memory foam mattresses that are extremely well-reviewed. And to add to the benefits, they give you a decent return policy. Like my mattress has a 100-day return policy. And again, people say the return policy is actually legit. And so once I read about that, I'm like, okay, I'll give it a try. And I'm now satisfied with it. So again, I think this speaks to the benefits of online commerce. I can now buy products where I felt like I was kind of getting screwed over in the past, and they were useful. But again, one of the interesting things, one of the promotions that the particular person that I bought this mattress from is if you then post something positive about it, and someone buys using your link to their website, they'll give you a $50 referral fee. So I was wondering, to what extent did I see all these glowing testimonials and reviews coming from people? Was it because they really loved the mattress, or was it because they were getting $50 for everyone that clicked on their link?
So you really do have to be a little bit of a skeptic to kind of sift through all of this stuff to find a nugget of truth. 800-642-1234. Let's take a caller. Mark is joining us this morning from Sheboygan. Mark, good morning.
I wanted to get back a little bit to the news portion of this. You know, as we're going through a budget cycle right now, I find the comments to be rather depressing. Almost all of us know something about something, and when an article is written about a topic that you know a great deal about, and then you read the comments and you're summarily dismissed just because of a viewpoint, but you actually have some expertise, I think it leaves you in a rather depressive state that these topics that you know a lot about, that you could actually make a difference in society about, is not going to be the prevalent viewpoint. It's going to be more the viewpoint of he who barks the loudest is the one who's going to be heard at the end of the day.
Mark, thanks for that insight. We are just about at weather time, so Joseph Riegel, if you could give a brief response to Mark, that'd be great.
Sure, I love that. I think that's a corollary of on the internet, no one knows you're a dog, and he who barks the loudest is the most heard.
800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, Facebook, Twitter, always to get in touch with the program. We're talking about the book, Reading the Comments, Likers, Haters, and Manipulators at the Bottom of the Web. Joseph Riegel is the author. He's my guest for the rest of this hour. Feel free to join us with your comments on comments. Stick around, more to come with Joseph Riegel. We're going to take a short break for some news headlines, and then we'll have more of our discussion. What do you think? Do you read the comments on articles in the newspaper and so forth? Do you rely on online reviews? What about Twitter? Ever been flamed? What was that like? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. those online comments. They can be amusing, they can be infuriating, they can be informative, they can be manipulative, they can be all sorts of things. Joseph Riegel has written a book called Reading the Comments, Likers, Haters, and Manipulators at the Bottom of the Web. We're talking about that this hour with him and with you at 800-642-1234. I'd like to maybe move the conversation along a little bit, Joseph Riegel, to talk about ways that websites can get the best out of their commenters. Is requiring real names a good first step there?
I think it's a possibility. A lot of people, for instance, Facebook and Google Plus, those social networks, did actually advocate that people use their real identities on the theory that that would help things. I heard someone state it as, if you know you're on Facebook and you're connected to your mother, you're going to have to be a little bit more careful about what you're saying when you comment elsewhere. So I think there might be something to it. But I also know that people say a lot of awful things under their real names online, so it's not just anonymity. And going back to John's earlier point about the virtues of online anonymous speech, I also still think we definitely need room for online anonymous speech. I'm not so concerned, actually, about the real name identity. I think the real question is just one of scale. How can you substantively participate in a community with 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 people all chiming in, and you really have no sense of who it is that you're talking to? So I think the online communities that tend to work best are ones where they have a little bit more intimate sense of scale, where you're interacting with some people that you don't necessarily always agree with, but you kind of know who they are, where you have the opportunity to build up some reputation within the community. Joseph says this sort of thing, this sort of way, and yeah, if you touch this issue, that's his hot button, but otherwise he's a pretty sensible sort of person. So I think a lot of it really has to do with a sense of scale and intimacy, and it's not so much about whether you could have a pseudonym, like I might have a pseudonym, not my real name, but it's a persistent pseudonym that people come to know and respect after a period of time, and I think that can be just as effective in terms of fostering a useful community.
You write about the numbers of people that it's possible for us to have a relationship with, and there's some actual science behind that. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's Dunbar's law. It's 150 people, and Robin Dunbar was evolutionary theorist, and he was wondering why is it that primates have such big brains. And he would look at all these things like, is it the food they eat? Is it their posture? And what he ended up finding was there's a correlation between brain size and group size. And in monkeys, for instance, they spend a lot of time grooming one another, picking the fleas out of one another's hair. And his argument is that humans have a correspondingly larger brain because we even have a larger group of people that we know. And not only do I know who my friends are, but I know who the friends of my friends are, or I know who the enemy of my enemy is, that sort of thing. So that higher order processing allows us a type of social grouping. So again, it's not the fleas, but we're able to gossip about people and who we can trust and who we should be careful of. And so Dunbar's number, that 150, he says you can find a lot of correlates of that. It's the size of a church congregation. It's the size of a military unit. But that's kind of the size of people. That's the optimum group of people where you have a sense of who it is in the community that you're with. You have a sense of who is a bonehead and who is smart and who has this particular hot button. And once you get beyond that number, you're going to be asking yourself, who is this person or who brought this person to the party? And then you're also going to be having scammers. So once you get big enough, I think a lot of social networks actually suffer from this. Once they become big enough, you have people on there hating and trolling and scamming and spamming. And I think that's actually what's happened to Twitter. I say Twitter had a sense of intimate serendipity at its start. You actually had celebrities who were tweeting normal people, and people were very excited, both the celebrities, because they felt they could be more real and authentic, and the people, because they were having these amazing interactions with celebrities. But Twitter's really now far too big just to have sort of unrestrained conversation with anyone that might want to tweet to you.
So I guess there's an inherent conflict here. I mean, we've got this whole internet, which is it's a global thing, and people can talk to people who live all the way across the world, the other side of the globe, And yet, you know, and if we could be in a community where people know each other, then we'll be better to each other. But we have millions and, well, we have billions probably of people on the Internet. Isn't there an inherent conflict there?
I think you're right. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a writer for The Atlantic and a blogger there, and he's had a very successful blogger. And he wrote something like, if you see below a news story, 1,000 comments join the conversation. That's not a conversation. That's sort of craziness. How can you keep up with that many people? The site Reddit, which is quite popular, is sometimes called the first front page of the Internet. They've had some trolls, and they've had some issues with particular subreddits. Those are subtopics. But I think that's actually a nice example because they have hundreds of subtopics, subreddits, and you can dig into something really small, like I'm into the Python programming language, and find that subreddit very useful. And so it has both the benefits of being relatively small scale. We're all there for a particular focused purpose of discussion. I know some of the people who post there frequently, but these can be people from all over the world. And so the thing that I tend to be a little bit skeptical about is trying to, like, have a substantive conversation with 1,000 people, people that you don't recognize and for whom you have, like, no relationship or reputation with. But I think there's ways to overcome that. Like Facebook, for instance, is this massive online network, but for the most part, you're interacting with people that you know.
Well, speaking of Facebook, Charles writes on Facebook, I've often envisioned a three-tiered comment division, policy wonks, general interest, and a trollosphere. An editor could quickly assign comments to one of those three tiers, and readers could occupy an environment where their comments belong among peers. Are there any sites that feature such stratified comment areas?
Yeah, so there's been a number of sites. I think Ars Technica, the popular blog Boing Boing, they don't do it a lot. One of the past innovations for the past couple of years was they'll say, what the editors will do is, here's the place where you can go and have your comments, and it could be the wonks and the trolls and the ordinary citizens, and we'll select the best comments and promote them to the actual article page. So we've been seeing more of that, I think. I think it's a good idea, and it's something people are doing. They feature or they highlight or they select the best comments.
Charles, thanks for that Facebook comment. Here's an email from George that goes back to something that we were talking about earlier, and it's something I want to come back to because this seems to be the real nub of what some people really find annoying about comments. George emails, I have a bit of a web presence, and the thing that bothers me about comments is the anonymity and lack of accountability. People say things online anonymously that they would never say face-to-face to me. I produced a video on bowl turning, and a resulting comment was, wow, you turned a piece of crap log into a piece of crap bowl. I can't imagine that viewer stating that in a face-to-face environment. I mean, we do say things online anonymously to people that we would never say if we were standing in front of them because we would probably expect to get punched in the face.
Yes. Social scientists have been trying to understand this for a couple of decades, even before the online space. So there's one by the name of Phil Zimbardo. He's a real famous social psychologist. He did the Stanford prison experiments where he had people get in particular uniforms, and the cops started behaving pretty poorly towards the prisoners in that experiment. And he did another experiment where he would have people dress up in gowns and hoods so they didn't have a sense of who they were, and then would ask them to shock, you know, 10, 20, 30, give someone so many volts of electricity. And, of course, the other person was an actor pretending to scream. And he found that when people were in these costumes masking their identity, they were more likely to shock people at a higher rate. And that's sometimes referred to as, one, disinhibition. We've lost some of our inhibitions. And two, they also refer to de-individuation, that maybe in a group of people or in anonymous circumstances, we lose a sense of ourselves and what our mores are. There's also theories about how with social media, not only do you lack a sense of accountability, but you can't see the effect that you're having on other people. Lindy West wrote a piece recently. I think she was also on This American Life, the radio show and podcast. And the title was something like, I met my... she actually had the opportunity to meet someone who trolled her very horribly. He actually created a Twitter account in the name and identity of her recently deceased father, and he would just tweet all these horrible things to her. And eventually he ended up apologizing. And I think part of that was because he did not really appreciate that she was a real person and the effect that he was having on her. And then when he finally came around, he realized that, you know, I did something horrible, and he apologized, which is kind of a nice happy ending So that I think that rarely happens in fact.
What do you think is the future of online commentary?
I think it's going to be a bit more of the same, and I don't mean to sound like a pessimist, but one of the things I'm a little bit skeptical of, again, is the Facebook model and this idea of the social graph. So, for instance, if we go back to reviews, there's this idea that, well, instead of relying upon the reviews of strangers, why not just listen to what your friends say that they like? They had a great sandwich at this particular deli or something like that. And again, my concern is that, one, it's kind of tempting all of your friends to become shills. And two, the platforms themselves, if we looked at Yelp, and even if we said Yelp had somehow managed to perfectly create a system where no one could manipulate, no one could cheat, no one could scam or spam the system, Yelp itself is incentivized to manipulate the system. And there were stories where a merchant would be called by a Yelp salesperson and say, hey, would you like to advertise with Yelp? We'll make sure we put a positive review on your website, on your page at the top, and we'll advertise on your competitors' sites and things like that. And the merchant said, no thanks, I'm doing really well in any case. And then a Yelp employee the next day would post a negative review of that merchant's establishment. And actually people said this was extortive and took Yelp to court, and Yelp actually won because of a particular law and the way it's written right now. But we've seen lots of instances of, like, say, Facebook taking someone's plus one of a particular product and turning it into an advertisement. There was a class action suit against Facebook, and that didn't go all the way through the courts. They settled out of court. Facebook mm-hmm. ended up paying those people money. But even to the extent that we turn to things like real identities and Facebook and the social networks and the social graph, there's still always, it seems, room for manipulation, unfortunately.
Okay. And we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, John.
Joseph M. Riegel, author of Reading the Comments, Likers, Haters, and Manipulators at the Bottom of the Web. Christy Taylor produced this hour of programming and also was the show director for this hour. Caleb Lado handled on-air production. Thanks to them for helping me this hour and you as well. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.